Welcome to the Present and the Jews, Part 14. Hey, appropriate in terms of Wilson. Discussing tonight Woodrow Wilson, the 28th president. It was Wilson, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Ilanish Masyona, Ben Rab Aryeh Leib. It was Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, more than any of his predecessors, who redefined the modern presidency. He was the first to see the presidency as the center of American government and the most powerful figure in the government, the most equal in what was supposed to be three co-equal branches of government. So in his own time, in his way, much more limited than you find today, Wilson eviscerated the notion of separation of powers. He was the first to define the presidency by utilizing its powers to bypass Congress. Again, it's in its own time, not as drastic as today, but nonetheless, what happens today found its precedent in Wilson. He came by all this honestly, even writing a book long before he became president, in which he outlined how America's system of government has become obsolete and how power had to be centralized in the presidency in order to meet the challenges of modernity, which itself is a very 21st century argument. Wilson was an academic, a university president, governor of New Jersey, only governor of New Jersey to become president, still, and the only Democrat elected president over that span of 36 years, 1896 to 1932, and he won by exploiting divisions in the Republican Party, as we discussed last week. Wilson was a progressive on steroids. He saw himself as the heir to Teddy Roosevelt, notwithstanding Roosevelt was a Republican, but even more, as one who would fundamentally transform the United States, make it more responsive to the people as he saw it, make it more paternalistic. He birthed into existence what today we call the welfare state or the nanny state, in which government assumes responsibility for taking care of the people rather than people assume responsibility for their own lives. And again, it all starts slowly, very limited fashion, until we have today, the government telling us how much soda we should have and whether wet restaurants should notify patrons how much salt is in the diet, etc. 100 years ago, these things weren't heard of. Now we take them for granted, if not always easily. As a young academic, Wilson had written about the virtues of limited government, which he championed until he took office. And as such, he remains, with Franklin Roosevelt, one of the patron saints of the Democratic Party. These days, and I literally mean these days, very recently, even as I speak, Wilson is caught in the maelstrom of political correctness. He was a racist. In fact, the first movie shown in the White House was one that he praised, the first motion picture, The Birth of a Nation, which extolled the Ku Klux Klan. Also in the news today by strange coincidence. So he had Wilson had a low opinion of blacks, and as such, there's a movement afoot, even as I speak, to remove his name from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Want to take his name off. And for the first time, Wilson sent U.S. troops to fight in an ongoing foreign conflict, World War I, after remaining neutral for the almost 3 years of the conflict, and after running for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Well, it didn't last long. Wilson entered that war just a little over a month after his second term began. And there were several consequences. Wilson became involved in shaping global affairs as no other president, not even Teddy Roosevelt before him, had. And America became, for the first time, an acknowledged global power, to which other nations look to for influence, material assistance, political support. Wilson became the first president to travel while in office to Europe, and he did so to participate in the Paris peace conference after the war, the conference that had mixed results and in a large sense paved the road to World War II. So Wilson became the first president to become a global leader. So how did he and we get there, and what role did Jews play in this quest? How did Woodrow Wilson relate to the Jews of his time? Thomas Woodrow Wilson was born in 1856 in Virginia, son of a preacher who bounced from parish to parish. Well into adulthood, he was known as Tommy Wilson. He spent most of the Civil War years in Augusta, Georgia, shielded from much of the harshness of the war, which never really made it to Augusta. His father, the preacher, served briefly in the Confederate Army and was not morally opposed to slavery, which partly explains Wilson's views on racial issues. It's hard to fathom in retrospect. Wilson remains the only president to earn a PhD, but he was dyslexic as a child and couldn't read until he was 10 years old. And he became attracted to oratory as a teenager, and for years studied public speaking. He'd even practice public speaking before the empty benches of his father's church. It was all political speech. And he became a powerful, very gifted orator. There's something attributed to Wilson that I've seen in other contexts as well, and I'll paraphrase it. Wilson said that if he's asked to speak for 10 minutes, he needs a week to prepare. But if they ask him to speak for an hour, he says, "I'm ready right now." And it's true in the rabbinate as well. If you know, sometimes a speaker will start to ramble and repeat, and it's a sign of lack of preparation. Wilson also had a tremendous appetite for knowledge, and he was limited only by the frequent bouts of boredom that his studies induced. He went first to Davidson College, strangers on the baseball team, 1880s. And then he transferred to and graduated from Princeton, where he excelled. Then it was called the College of New Jersey. After graduation, he went to law school, hated it, never finished. Practiced law, hated it. And then he enrolled in the newly opened graduate school, named for the writer James Hopkins. What'd he write? A check. He wrote the check to start the school. Wilson's dissertation was on congressional government, and it was published and widely read, and he soon entered the life of the academic, teaching at the women's colleges, Bryn Mawr and Wesleyan, and then back to his alma mater, Princeton, where for whatever reason he dropped the first name Thomas, and he became just Woodrow Wilson, and he became a very popular lecturer at Princeton. And on the lecture circuit across the country, really, he became a highly paid professor. Today, he'd be a celebrity academic. Think Larry Sabato as an example. And in 1902, he became the president of Princeton University. And he wrote and wrote. His last book, published in 1908, was entitled Constitutional Government of the United States. I recommend the movie, not the book. But in the book, he suggested an enhanced role for the president, and he lamented the lack of true leadership as he saw it, and that became his blueprint for the presidency. Well, in a distinctly Republican era, Wilson began to be mentioned as a potential Democrat contender for high office. So he was persuaded to run for New Jersey governor, and he was elected in 1910. And he spoke of America's ideals, not just of its growing prosperity, of equal justice, of human rights, and of America's example for mankind generally. It was not typical fare, but it found its audience. Wilson, who always had a prickly personality, offended people as well, especially supporters. Right after he was elected, he marginalized the New Jersey bosses that had made him governor and almost immediately began a presidential campaign for the 1912 nominations. He really served as governor effectively maybe less than 2 years, maybe even a year in effect. And for the Democrats, there really were slim pickings in the among their presidential hopefuls. How often could William Jennings Bryan run and lose? It happened 3 times already. And Wilson really was uniquely situated. He was a New Jersey governor, therefore from the Northeast, and he was born in Virginia, raised in the Deep South, and so he's perceived as a Southerner. That's not to say he feigned different accents wherever he spoke, as some modern politicians do, Democrats, but it does say that Wilson had broad appeal, and it's true he was an outsider. He was a relatively new politician, and all he had to defeat wasn't easy, but he had to defeat the incumbent Speaker of the House, Champ Clark, for the nomination. It took 46 ballots, and Wilson only clinched it when Bryan threw his support behind Wilson and against Clark. And Wilson then appointed Bryan the Secretary of State. Wilson campaigned for true free enterprise, was an even more vehement opponent of monopolies and the robber barons, the tycoons, than was Roosevelt. And he benefited, of course, from the big Republican rift between Roosevelt and Taft. In the end, Wilson won with just 42% of the vote, but an overwhelming majority in the Electoral College, 435 to 88 for Roosevelt. And to Wilson, it was destiny. Remember, he was a preacher's son. He was a pious Christian also. When the head of the Democratic National Committee came to discuss patronage after the election was won, Wilson dismissed him and said, "I owe you nothing." I quote, you have to quote this, you can't make it up. "Remember that God ordained that I should be the next president of the United States. Neither you nor any other mortal or mortals could have prevented that." Well, that's a sentiment that other presidents have had as well, but they don't usually speak that, you know, speak those thoughts. That haughtiness would bedevil him in a number of ways, but it would also propel him to redefine the office of the presidency and make it into a unilaterally powerful position, the most equal, so to speak, of the three co-equal branches of government. And Wilson always was a strong believer in providence. True to his upbringing, he prayed every day, read the Bible every day, and even when he changed his mind on something, as one of his allies said, he didn't feel the need to explain himself. He was just doing God's work. And one day God felt one thing, and the next day God changed his mind, so therefore his faithful servant changed along with it. Wilson had a number of close advisors. I'll mention one at the very beginning, familiar name to all of us. One person brought into Wilson's inner circle was a crusading lawyer that he had long known and admired, David Brandeis. Now, Brandeis was born in Louisville, Kentucky, also 1856. His parents were immigrants from Prague, and Brandeis grew up completely secular, really alienated, detached from the Jewish community. His family even celebrated the Christian holidays as cultural observances. But the Brandeis family, even in Kentucky, was opposed to slavery. They opposed secession, and they even surreptitiously helped the Union during the Civil War. Brandeis only learned about his heritage later in life when he established a relationship with his maternal uncle, his mother's sister, Louis Naftali Dembitz, who was a firm Jew his entire life, also a lawyer in Louisville. And Dembitz became a mentor to his nephew. And Brandeis, after Dembitz died, changed his name, in fact, his middle name, Louis David Brandeis, to Louis Dembitz Brandeis, in his uncle's honor. Brandeis, after studying for a while overseas, his parents went back to Bohemia and Germany, Brandeis entered Harvard Law School at age 18 and graduated as valedictorian with the highest scores ever. I read that his scores are only topped in the last decade or so, or two decades, by someone else. Say what you will about Brandeis, he was a genius and a very good soul. He became a liberal with a capital L, a leader of the progressive movement, an advocate for the poor, the workers, the downtrodden. He was suspicious of big banks, of monopolies, of big corporations. He became known as the people's lawyer. Handled public interest lawsuits. One of the few people in his era who, at a certain time, after he had some money, he made a fortune, but he lived frugally, he became a pro bono lawyer, just taking cases for free on issues that meant something to him, and he really did not care for wealthy people. He became close to Wilson. He supported Wilson for president, even wrote a book in 1914 called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It, which of course was an anti-big bank tract. Brandeis was considered by Wilson for the post of Attorney General, which would have been revolutionary. He did not get the position, and not only because the non-Jews who ran the big banks and corporations opposed him. Wilson consulted Jacob Schiff, we spoke about last week as well, who told Wilson that Brandeis was not really a representative Jew because he was alienated from the Jewish community and uninvolved. And in fact, part of it was that he was completely secular, but also he had become a Zionist in the previous decade, and in fact was the head of the Zionist Organization of America, and that became his Jewish identity, and a lot of the wealthy German Jews were not Zionists. So Wilson kept Brandeis on as an informal advisor and would hold for him a very historic appointment that we'll get to in a little while. Wilson's primary advisor was someone he had befriended for only a few years before he became president, and then grew to see him as his soulmate, Colonel Edward House, the title being purely honorary. It's interesting. Ad Hayom in Texas, in Kentucky, and some other states, that's the Kentucky Colonel. The governor has the right to bestow military titles on people as a lark, just in an honorary fashion. Wilson would rely on House extensively during his presidency until his relationship foundered. He felt that House spoke for him and thought like him. House, though, in his writings, comes across as a typical Jew hater. But whether it was intense or just social is debated. House was there to hold Wilson together when Wilson suffered the great tragedy of his life in 1914 in the White House. Wilson had married his wife Ellen in 1885. Together they had three daughters. Wilson was very passionate, strange for an academic, but he wrote very passionate love letters to his wife before and during their marriage. One of their daughters, Margaret, became a Hindu nun in an ashram, sounds like the 1970s, in India in 1940, where she died. But long before that, Ellen unfortunately died in the White House on August 6, 1914, of kidney disease, and Wilson was distraught. Whatever his external demeanor, and he looked like a stern person, even if he wasn't, he was extremely dependent on her, very much in love with her, and House took on for a time increased responsibilities for the presidency. Wilson sank into a depression for months, even said to House he feels unfit to continue to serve as president. But 7 months after Ellen died, Wilson was introduced by his niece to a widow living in Washington, wealthy widow named Edith Galt, and he married her, not without controversy, in December 1915. Edith was a very strong personality as well, and she would clash repeatedly with House over the years, attempting to sideline him. Neither could anticipate the way their relationship would evolve in 1919 and beyond. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Wilson set out to reshape the American politics and the presidency. So he first restored a practice that had been abandoned by Thomas Jefferson. You know, the Constitution requires the president give Congress an annual report on the State of the Union, and Jefferson began submitting it in writing, feeling that delivering the speech in person was too monarchical, like the British king or queen addressing the opening session of the House of Commons. It was Woodrow Wilson who decided to flout tradition. We suffer from that until today. And he began delivering the State of the Union address in person beginning in 1914, and every president since has done the same, and for similar reasons. The pomp and ceremony underscore the power and prestige of the presidency and sends a clear message as to who's the real power in American government. So it's ironic. For the same reason that Jefferson stopped it, That's why Wilson restored it, and his critics did not like it. He would thereafter make regular trips to Capitol Hill to press for one reform or another. When there was a resistance to his bill to lower tariffs, he took his case directly to the people, basically accusing the high tariff supporters of being in bed with big business, and it worked. It was Brandeis's influence that Wilson pushed through the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank. Federal Reserve Act created a central bank that would control the banks and regulate the currency, along with 12 regional banks. Likewise, Brandeis was instrumental in helping Wilson create the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, to regulate business. What it did was give government more control over business and the lives of people. And these agencies affect our lives until today. Add to that the imposition of the personal income tax that had been approved through a constitutional amendment under Taft, and this too was a revolution. So it started under Wilson. It was a 1% tax on a small portion of income. That became 2% during World War I. In a few years, by the end of the war, the government revenue stream had completely transformed from 2/3 coming from tariffs and excise taxes to 2/3 coming from personal income and estate taxes. Well, 1%, 2%, once in a number, within a few decades, the top tax rate would be 90% and remained there really until the Kennedy era, and then we cut it to 70, and then the Reagan era. But President Sanders is determined to bring it back to 90%. It was the close relationship of Brandeis and Wilson that led Wilson to shock the country and haters of Brandeis and nominate Brandeis in January 1916 to be an associate justice of the Supreme Court, the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. This was not an easy sell, not only because Brandeis was a Jew. There are Jews who didn't want him to be a justice because he was a Jew. There were non-Jews didn't want to be a justice because he was a Jew, and many non-Jews did not want him because he was an extremely controversial activist. It took more than 4 months for the Senate to confirm Brandeis by a 47-22 vote. Think about it like this. There has never been a confirmed justice whose nomination process took as long as the process that confirmed Louis Brandeis. There have been others that were rejected in the end, but no confirmed justice took as long to be accepted, to be ratified, as Brandeis. There were fellow justices. Justice McReynolds was one, famously. In 20 years, he never said a word to Brandeis. He just hated Jews. But he became a legendary liberal justice, Louis Brandeis, and very strange by today's standards, he remained in contact and an advisor to Woodrow Wilson as well. You know, as I thought about it, maybe it shouldn't be so strange. There's no reason why they can't meet in private and let the Chief Justice explain to the President what's good, bad, acceptable, unacceptable, be another informal advisor. I just read a few weeks ago, after Justice Scalia died, he was questioned by some muckraking journalist, how can he hear a case in which a particular lawyer is arguing the case when Scalia plays poker with that lawyer every week. And Scalia brushed him off with a Sicilian hand gesture and said to him three words, get a life, which is actually sage advice. You know, we would probably have a rational political discourse if more people just get a life and focus on what's important and what's not important. So that was Brandeis. Also strange, in retrospect, Wilson had very little foreign policy knowledge or experience when he became president. He was a poli-sci guy. He was a domestic affairs person. Foreign affairs follows the president to the White House. He was first forced to involve himself in the Mexican uprising in 1914, where a coup overthrew the elected government, and Wilson refused to recognize the new government, which was also unusual by those standards. And this led to further unrest, another coup, a tax on Americans over the border by Francisco Pancho Villa, and finally raids on Mexico led by the American general Black Jack Pershing. In 1915, Wilson sent U.S. troops to Haiti. In 1916, sent troops to the Dominican, both to suppress domestic strife. All of this was unusual. It was against Wilson's instincts, except his moralistic ones, but it began to shape the American self-perception as a global power. In August 1914, the Great War broke out in Europe, and Wilson pledged absolute neutrality. For several reasons, he saw no American interest in the war. The U.S. was far from the war zone, and the sides in the conflict divided the American population. Remember, the United States is a nation of immigrants from Germany in large part. For years, German immigrants represented the largest proportion, not necessarily Jews, even non-Jews. And you had many from Russia, from Britain, from France, Austria, Hungary. Many Americans being sent to war would find themselves fighting against their ancestral lands. It would be hard to do. Conversely, other Americans hated their ancestral lands and would have loved to fight Russian Jews against the Tsar, Irish Americans against Great Britain. So it was very complicated. And there was no obvious rooting interest when the war began. And it was also unknown how the war would end. It was basically a stalemate until early 1918. So the U.S. was neutral, although it did bankroll both sides for a time, and that probably prolonged the war. Bryan, who was Wilson's Secretary of State, was adamantly opposed to U.S. involvement in the war. In fact, he resigned at a certain point. The U.S. could have remained uninvolved, but for the German U-boat attacks on Atlantic shipping that sunk some U.S. ships, infamously killed Americans on the Lusitania in 1915, and angered everyone, including Wilson. When Wilson issued an ultimatum in 1915 to the Germans to stop, and they did for a time, Bryan, who was a pacifist, was so angered by the tone that he resigned as Secretary of State. But Wilson ran for re-election in 1916 with a slogan, "He kept us out of war," and he won a very close election, defeating Charles Evans Hughes 49.2% to 46.1%, and just as close in the Electoral College, 277 to 254. Hughes, think about it today, it's just hard to put ourselves in this framework. Charles Evans Hughes was a Supreme Court justice, a sitting justice, who resigned to run for president, later became Secretary of State, and still later became returned to the court as the Chief Justice after Taft died. Meanwhile, it's a trivia question, Wilson is one of two presidents to be elected twice without ever having won 50% of the vote. Who's the other? No, Bill Clinton. The outcome was, Clinton ran twice, did not get half the country to support him. The outcome was so close in some states that the winner of the election was not known for several days. The great irony, of course, I mentioned before, is that within a month after Wilson was sworn in for a second term, the United States declared war on Germany. The Germans had restarted their policy of sinking ships, sunk several American ships in March 1917. They refused to pledge they would stop. There started to be a demand for a war. Teddy Roosevelt insisted that America go to war, called Wilson a coward. As I mentioned last week, he went to the White House, demanded that he, blind in one eye, in his late 50s, be given his own division to go fight with his horse against the Germans. He ridiculed Wilson. In addition to that, the Americans had intercepted a telegram between Germany and Mexico in which Germany pledged to help Mexico regain the American Southwest if Mexico supports Germany in the war. And all these were just the straws that broke the camel's back. On April 4th, 1917, Congress overwhelmingly approved a declaration of war. It's a very trying time, 1917. The war raged on in Europe, almost without any end in sight. That same March, in fact, the same week that Wilson was sworn in, the Tsar was overthrown in Russia. Within a half year, the Bolsheviks had taken over, and they would negotiate an exit from World War II by surrendering land to Germany. And this enabled the Germans to concentrate on the Western Front, and it was the influx of American troops in late 1917 that began to turn the tide. The war was popular, but not universally so. And Wilson, who was a liberal, but a haughty liberal, took many liberties with personal liberties. And again, in retrospect, it always happens during war, and then American society makes amends after the war. At Wilson's insistence, Congress passed the Espionage Act in 1917, the Sedition Act a little after that, that made criticism of the government illegal, made insulting or mocking the government illegal. People were jailed, among them Eugene V. Debs, who was a socialist leader, jailed for expressing opposition to the war or opposition to the draft. Thousands of immigrants were deported back to their countries. So if you think about Roosevelt and the Japanese Americans during the war, it was actually less harsh than what Wilson had done in taking these American citizens who were immigrants and shipping them back to their home countries. And after the war, when communism already began to spread and the Soviet Union became established, the Attorney General, Mitchell Palmer, launched raids that arrested alleged communists, incarcerated them, and the United States experienced for the first time the menace of the Red Scare. During the war, the government sharply increased income taxes, doubled in fact, and began to regulate various industries and ration food and fuel. Wilson appointed as the head of the War Industries Board one Bernard Baruch, a South Carolinian Jew, son of a surgeon who served in the Confederate Army. Bernard Baruch became a banker, a financier, advisor to several presidents, lived a long life. 1870, just 5 years after the Civil War ended, died in 1965. He intermarried, a harbinger of the American Jewish future, his three children raised as Episcopalians. Baruch always remained close to Wilson, in fact, helped him buy his house after the presidency, and as we know, as a college, a part of the CUNY system named after him in New York. So, what was the American interest in World War I, besides the attacks on American shipping? To Wilson, it was not the war as much as it was the peace that would follow, a peace in which he would attempt to impose his ideas for a better, even ideal world. And Wilson was an idealist, like few presidents have been. Of course, the ideal world would never come because it can never come. We're dealing with human beings. It was a difficult time. Jews in particular felt the tugs and twists and turmoil of World War I like few other groups. One of the few wars in history in which Jews fought each other. Russian Jews against German Jews, for example. So much of the war was fought in close combat, trench to trench. There are many reports of Jewish soldiers from one country hearing soldiers from their enemy cry out Shema Yisrael as they died. It was a brutal war for everyone. Remember, the war involved the use of poison gas, but especially Jews in the land of Israel, then under the rule of the Ottomans, who was the Turks were on the sides of the Germans. In Eretz Yisrael, there was real hunger. People actually died of starvation in the land of Israel during the war. European Jews, especially in Russia, Poland, Lithuania, suffered from severe hardship. And the Russian Revolution after the war made it worse. During the war, 600,000 Jews were banished from the front by the Tsar, who did not trust them, despite the fact that 500,000 Russian Jews fought in the Tsarist army. And the war resulted in Jewish youth being radicalized as communists, socialists, anarchists, and the yeshiva world was devastated and would not really recover. The world was changing around the Jewish community, but most Jews did not know how to react. German Jews supported Germany and fought valiantly for Germany. About 12,000 German Jews died in the German army. 80% served in combat, numbers that were concealed during and after the war so the German military could blame the Jews for Germany's defeat. The philosopher, the Reform Rabbi Hermann Cohn, about whom Rav Soloveitchik wrote his dissertation, Cohn traveled to the U.S. in 1915 to try to enlist the support of American Jews on Germany's side. The Zionist organization maintained an office in Berlin during the war and in London, hedging its bets, not knowing who would prevail. About 250,000 American Jews fought in World War I. Most overwhelmingly were volunteers. Around 3,500 Jews died in battle, with 12,000 more wounded. But think about it, Jews were 3% of the population then, but 5% of the combat deaths during the war. Not unusual for an immigrant population tries to show its or prove its patriotism. One Jew, Sergeant William Schemann, was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. When? Last June. A little late, just a century late. He has two daughters in their 80s who came to the White House, and Obama presented them with his Medal of Honor, denied to him almost clearly because he was Jewish. Well, what of the post-war world? One astonishing outcome of World War I and the great success of the Zionist movement was the recognition by much of the world community of the rights of the Jewish people to a homeland in the land of Israel. So what was Wilson's view of Zionism, of the Balfour Declaration? Fundamentally, it was a British initiative, but historians differ widely as to Wilson's position, with claims that he was in favor, that he was neutral, and that he was hostile. Basically, on every side of the issue, and to some extent they were all right, and the documentary record now available indicates that at different times he was on different sides of the matter. The Balfour Declaration was issued by the British government on November 2nd, 1917, in the name of Lord Arthur Balfour, the Foreign Secretary, to the Zionist establishment in Great Britain, stated, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That's the whole declaration. And each clause was fraught with meaning and controversy and reflected the differing views in the British government, not to mention the Jewish community. Not to go into in detail, you can pick it up on the website, one of our great decisions from a few years back, but note the language. A national home, not necessarily a state. Best endeavors, no guarantees. Existing non-Jewish communities should not be prejudiced, a sop to the Arabs. Status enjoyed by Jews elsewhere, that's a concession to anti-Zionist Jews who fear charges of dual loyalty and were largely uninterested in Jewish national life in any event. Part of the backdrop was that during World War I, as I mentioned, the Zionist organization was still based in Berlin, and a real split had occurred between those Zionists who thought the Allies had the best chance of prevailing in the Great War and aiding the Zionist cause, and those who felt the Germans would emerge victorious. And World War I was a war that ground on for years, with both sides making little progress, with millions of soldiers being fodder for the machinations of the politicians. And no side really had any great advantage until shortly before the war ended. And it ended really so precipitously that generated a lot of the antagonism against Jews in Germany that felt that they had been betrayed by some outside force, because from their perspective, the war was going swimmingly until right before Armistice Day, November 11th, 1918. And it's hard to imagine retrospect. Nobody here remembers the war firsthand, I see. But the war was never fought on German soil. Think about it. Compare that to World War II. The war was fought almost exclusively, the Western Front, in France, in Belgium, in the Netherlands. It never made it to Germany. So to go from a situation where you're living basically bucolic lives, to your country surrendering, and the Kaiser abdicating, to them it was too sudden a shock. Well, for this reason, while negotiations were ongoing with the British about the Balfour Declaration, similar proposals were being explored with the Germans, that they should commit to a Jewish homeland in exchange for Jewish support in the war. In the end, it seems the Germans never seriously entertained the idea of a German-style Balfour Declaration. Part of it was because it wasn't Germany that controlled the land of Israel. It was the Ottoman Empire, their ally. They had no reason to tell them to forfeit any of the territory. But any public outreach, though, to Britain, because the Ottomans still controlled the land of Israel, could jeopardize Jewish life in the land of Israel even more than it was already being ravaged by the war. Even Jewish international relief efforts could be suspended by the Turks. So where was Wilson? Well, the Balfour Declaration was issued on November 2nd, 1917. On September 3rd, 2 months earlier, the British asked Wilson for his thoughts on the advisability of such a declaration. Wilson said the time was not ripe. By October 6th, a month later, Wilson had changed his mind and told the British to go ahead. What changed? And I have to say that when it was issued, Wilson became coy and was utterly silent about American support for the Balfour Declaration and did not endorse it until a year later. So what happened? Well, there are a number of theories. Some say the American Zionists succeeded in changing Wilson's mind. That's the theory put forward by the American Zionists, led by Brandeis. So in this, they had to bypass Colonel House, who was anti-Jewish and anti-Zionist. Others claim that the change was in House, that he was persuaded to support the Zionist endeavor, and that House convinced Wilson. And still others claim that House was always pro-Zionist, and he had to drag along a reluctant Wilson. Needless to say, the historical record is muddled. To be sure, the process had been in the works for months. Already in April, shortly after the U.S. entered World War I, Brandeis, remember, he's a Supreme Court Justice, but nonetheless, he's head of the ZOA also, Brandeis received a cable from Baron James Rothschild in Britain advising him of what was transpiring in London, telling him that the Russian Zionists were now on board for a British declaration and Brandeis should do what he can to secure American support. The request caught American Zionists by surprise. The United States had declared war on Germany, not on Turkey. Turkey was not harming American shipping. So that minefield had to be navigated, especially considering that the Turks, during the war, had already massacred 1 million Armenians. Who says the same couldn't happen in Israel also? On May 9th, 1917, after heated meetings, the American Zionists cabled London that they were on board with the declaration in favor of a Jewish homeland, but without mentioning that it would be a British protectorate. And all this was designed to forestall a catastrophe if Britain did not win the war. It was this proposal that Brandeis and Stephen Wise tried to sell to House and to Wilson. House was enthusiastic to their faces. Stephen Wise was a former rabbi born in Budapest. He was close to Wilson, later to FDR. We'll discuss it more in a few weeks. Alone with Wilson, House advised Wilson to oppose the plan. It wouldn't be the last time that a president or presidential advisor dazzled Wise to his face, only to dismiss him behind closed doors. Duplicitous? Of course. Brandeis met with Wilson in May, Wise met him in June, and each time Wilson expressed his sympathy, but did not commit to a public statement, so as not to antagonize the Turks. And Wilson, like many of his successors, was masterly at telling his visitors what they wanted to hear, even if different sets of visitors were on opposite sides of an issue. Wilson was consulted by the British in September. It was after a contentious cabinet meeting in Britain. for whatever reason, neither Balfour nor the Prime Minister Lloyd George were present at the meeting, and a minor minister, a Jew, a prominent assimilated Jew, Edwin Montague, spoke against the Balfour Declaration, and he represented those British Jews who were against Jewish nationalism. That was when House responded for Wilson that he was not keen on such a declaration. Sympathy, but no commitment of support. Balfour was disheartened. Chaim Weizmann cabled Brandeis, who again got to work on Wilson, to little avail. House wrote to Wilson in October, I quote, "The Jews from every tribe have descended in force, and they seem determined to break in with a jimmy if they are not let in." It was then that there was a leak in the press that the Germans were considering a statement in support of a Jewish homeland. And that brought the matter back to the British and American governments for reconsideration. So for the first time, the British sent Wilson an actual text, almost identical to the eventual declaration. Brandeis and Wise met with House, and Wilson signaled his approval as long as it was not publicized. A few weeks later, November 2nd, the Balfour Declaration was issued. That same week, the Kerensky government in Russia was overthrown by the Bolsheviks. Now, obviously, we can't fully know what changed Wilson's mind, whether it was fear of the Germans, support for the British, desire to curry favor with the rulers of Russia, keep them in the war, or even a genuine sympathy for the Zionist aspirations. Who knows? In the U.S., Jewish anti-Zionists descended on Wilson, urging him to publicly oppose the Balfour Declaration. Wise warned him that such would happen. Wilson responded that his wastebasket is big enough to take care of all such letters. And he did tell Wise at one point, it is self-serving but could be true too, that Zionism appealed his religious instincts. He, the son of a preacher. And he said, "To think that I, the son of the man, should be able to help restore the Holy Land to its people." Even so, Wilson did not make his support of the Balfour Declaration public until the summer of 1918, after the Turks had been defeated, and just months after General Allenby entered Yerushalayim as the conqueror. Well, Wilson had entered the war, in his own words, to make the world safe for democracy. And presidents since then have seized on this vision. Not all of them. FDR, JFK, Reagan, Bush II, with Obama a stark retreat from that vision. Wilson left the conduct of the war. He knew nothing about warfare. Left it to Black Jack Pershing, except for insisting against the will of the British and French that the U.S. retain its own units and own strategy, and not simply turn over their soldiers to British or French command, which is what they wanted. Wilson developed his 14 points, which he introduced to Congress in January 1918, the framework for a new world order, open published treaties, free navigation, free trade, arms reduction, self-determination for countries, and especially an international body, a League of Nations, that would adjudicate disputes and render war obsolete. He was an idealist in a world of pragmatists, realists, and a couple of vengeful people too. Wilson took his points to Europe in the winter of 1919 when the Paris Peace Conference opened at the Palace of Versailles, just 2 months after the armistice. He was the first president to travel as president to Europe. And he was away for 6 months almost in Europe. Unprecedented, unduplicated. No other president ever spent that much time away from the United States, as much as we want some to. And he effectively lost control of the country while he was away. Nevertheless, and this appealed to Wilson's ego, he was beloved in Europe. Crowds of thousands threw flowers at him. He was hailed as signs. Champion of the rights of man, Wilson the Just. He assumed everyone shared his outlook and his concept of the future. Whatever was Wilson's image of the future world, the British and French just wanted vengeance against the Germans, and they resented and ridiculed Wilson. Clemenceau was the premier of France on the 14 points of Wilson. God gave man 10 commandments and they broke every one. Now Wilson wants to impose 14. And the underlying factor was that France had lost 1.1 million people, men in battle, the British 900,000 in battle, and the US just 53,000 men in battle. So the Europeans had much more blood that had been shed. They were quite insistent on reparations, as well as humiliating Germany. It was not enough that the Kaiser had abdicated. In the end, it took months to work out a compromise. They agreed to Wilson's League of Nations in exchange for Wilson's agreement on German reparations and the ceding of some German territory, especially the Saar, to France. Germany was to be disarmed. And all of this led inexorably to World War II. That treaty in Versailles was signed in June 1919. And the Europeans got in their minds to carve up the world, to satisfy ethnic demands, reduce sources of tension. What happened in the Land of Israel is part of it. The secret Sykes-Picot Agreement, 1915, carved up the Middle East, created Iraq, among other countries. The Allies created Yugoslavia on the ruins of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Winston Churchill's hand in everything literally sat with maps, drawing lines, creating countries, and it worked for a time. Think about it. Yugoslavia lasted 75 years. Iraq lasted almost 100 years before each collapsed into bitter wars between the various ethnic groups. And the Balfour Declaration was part of this as well. So too was carving out the eastern bank of the Jordan, originally part of the Jewish homeland, and giving it to the Hashemites. Wilson came home to a country that was no longer interested in his nationalist schemes. He'd been gone a long time. The economy needed to be placed back on a peacetime footing. Country fell into recession. But Wilson focused on urging Congress to ratify the Paris Peace Treaty, including the creation of the League of Nations. Imagine a president submitting a treaty to Congress that requires two-thirds approval, as the Constitution says. Boy, that doesn't happen anymore. But the Republicans had recaptured Congress in 1918, and both for substantive reasons and pure partisan politics, refused to endorse the League of Nations. Wilson came to Congress, urged passage of the treaty, arguing that for the first time in history, a nation, the United States, had gone to war, not because their material interests were threatened, but as what he called disinterested champions of right. And it was true. And he added that henceforth, whether they like it or not, America is a world power. The hand of God, he said, has led us this way. Congress was not enthusiastic. Arrogant to the end, Wilson decided to take his case to the people rather than appeal to Congress. He traveled cross-country, made numerous speeches, denounced the Republicans, who are the majority now, as petty, small-minded, mean-spirited, and he got nowhere. The Senate was poised to repudiate Wilson when Wilson suffered a debilitating stroke in October 1919. He was paralyzed on the left side. His cognitive faculties, speech, movement were all impaired. Unimaginable today, the country was not informed. For more than a year, Edith Wilson ran the country, as House had already been shut out of Wilson's life. Access to Wilson was severely limited. No bills were signed, almost a year and a half. She would inform aides whether he said yes or no on a particular issue that came up. From his sickbed, he refused to compromise on anything. Occasionally, they would trot him out to a cabinet meeting, and he would sit there for an hour. He could say nothing publicly. The treaty fell 8 votes short of a two-thirds majority, 55-39. The U.S. did not join the League of Nations, which proved to be an ineffectual force. Nevertheless, Wilson was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1919. That was another consequence of the war that affected us. Americans began to object to large-scale immigration, and restrictive laws were soon enacted. The heyday of Jewish immigration was over. Finally, Wilson was a complicated person. He is a progressive icon, and that's, as I mentioned, recently crashed into the reality that he was, for the most part, a racist, a supporter of segregation, who praised the contributions of the KKK to Southern life. Racial violence broke out late in his administration, notably in Chicago, where it hasn't yet ended, apparently, and Wilson didn't respond. Dozens of people killed. He had no response. American blacks fought in World War I, but the army was carefully segregated, and he saw blacks, I quote, as an ignorant and inferior race. Similar nasty sentiments can be found about his general attitude towards Jews, although he obviously had warm relations with many individual Jews, which is also not that uncommon. It was during Wilson's presidency that Leo Frank was falsely accused of murdering a girl who worked in his factory in Georgia, and then lynched by a mob in 1915 when his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. Wilson, if he said anything about his fate, I couldn't find it. Although Vice President Marshall publicly supported commutation, Wilson was silent. It stands to reason, though, that Wilson appointed Brandeis to the Supreme Court in part in response to the Leo Frank travesty. Frank, by the way, is buried right here at Mount Carmel Cemetery in Queens. Similarly, almost simultaneously, the blood libel trial of Mendel Bayless was taking place in Moscow. And again, there's no record of Wilson protesting the trial. Think again to Roosevelt's response to the Kishinev pogrom. The trial resulted in Bayless's acquittal after an international uproar. By the way, Bayless went to Israel, then he lived in America, where he died in 1934. Ironically, he's also buried in Mount Carmel Cemetery in Glendale, not far from Leo Frank. Where Wilson ranks on the list of presidents depends on one's politics today. Liberals idolize him. Conservatives see how he changed the presidency in ways that abruptly changed our form of government, and did it, encroaching on Congress's prerogatives and on civil liberties. So he was close to some Jewish advisors, but on the real issues during his life that would impact Jewish history, Wilson took a secondary role. He died. He lingered with his stroke for a number of years. He died in 1924, just a few months after successor Warren Harding also died, and he's remembered by us mainly for Brandeis and not obstructing the Balfour Declaration. He's the only president actually buried in Washington, D.C., but he dramatically changed the nature and powers of the presidency, and that would impact on American Jewish history and the future as well. I thank you all very much. So next week we'll look at the big three of the presidents in the 1920s, Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. I thank you all.